Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
This week on Meet and Three, I'm about to go on maternity leave. This is Katie Mosman-Wadler, and before I leave you in the incredibly capable hands of Team HRN, we're rounding out Season 5 with a deep dive into the food rules, weird cravings, and overall hype about eating while pregnant.
There are a lot of safe foods to eat, and we shouldn't be sort of assuming that just because something is raw that it's dangerous.
I just found myself feeling like there was an alien piloting my body and brain, and totally changed the way that I ate.
So was it the eggplant? Sure. Why not? I just don't know.
Tune in to this week's episode of Meat and Three anywhere you listen to podcasts. I'll be back soon with our newest and tiniest producer in tow.
Hello, and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. On our first episode of 2020, we are joined by Chef Josh Emmett, who just released his newest cookbook, The Recipe. It spans 150 of the world's famous chefs and 300-plus of what he considers to be the classic recipes of the last 50 years. You can check out recipes from Daniel Boulud, Dominique Ancel, and Jean Georges, while Chef talks to us about the skills that connect all of these incredible chefs and some tips for cooking for your home kitchen. Later in the show, our studio engineer Jeet sits down with singer-songwriter Mia Gladstone, who performs a live blend of R&B, pop, and jazz for us. Her debut EP, Grow, earned high praise, and her latest single, Geekin', has been turning heads too. So sit back, relax, and here's another episode of Snacky Tunes.
We talk about food, we talk about music, with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
Just like a farmer, giving me a headache, let me roll my marijuana, throw me into conversations, do me the dishonor, I'm focused on elevation, living in nirvana, hold it down tonight, get your mind alright, don't play double sides, all the trends will.
Oh, Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. I am on the line with Josh Emmett, who is calling all the way from New Zealand. Chef, thank you so much for joining us.
How are you? It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yes, it was great meeting you last year during your book release for The Recipe here in New York. It was wonderful to have that home-cooked meal in that beautiful apartment.
Yeah, that was fun, right? Seems like a decade ago now, but yeah, that was a good time. We had a great time up in New York when we were there.
Yeah. So you grew up in Hamilton, New Zealand, and one of the things you talk about in your childhood is this huge walk-in pantry that was fully stocked, but the actual meat of the meal was not in there. What are some favorites of pulling together meals from the pantry, and what lessons did you learn on how you cook from a fully stocked reserve?
Well, we always had, one thing we didn't buy was a lot of processed ingredients, I think, and we lived on a farm, so we had, a lot of fruit trees and a pretty, reasonably good vegetable garden. But, you know, my mother always encouraged us either to get out of the house and get out and play around on the farm, or, I was often in the kitchen and I was allowed to make sort of whatever I wanted. We had all the ingredients that you could, lots of eggs. We had chooks, chickens, running around. And so we could make cakes and that sort of thing. And I had a bit of a sweet tooth. So I made a huge amount. I started baking at quite a young age. I made a huge amount of cakes. And I suppose the great thing about that was that you made a cake, you owned the cake. So we ate as much as we liked. There wasn't much of a restriction put on that. So it was brilliant for me and my brother and my sister and that sort of thing. So that's really where cooking started for me.
What ended up being your cake specialty from childhood?
I made all sorts. I made a chocolate caramel slice, which was one of the first things. I used to make pavlovas, lots of different versions of pavlovas, all sorts of biscuits, Anzac biscuits, or, your classic chocolate chip cookies, or what else? Banana cakes. Made a lot of banana cakes. We always seem to have bananas floating around, and different icings. So, a lot of your real classics. I really enjoyed it.
And what are some of the lessons from those days that you still carry through to cooking these days?
Have confidence in recipes. I think I used to. I remember thinking back then, even. When I was making cakes then, that I wasn't, it was the first time for me and I wasn't really sure that anything would ever work out. And I think even these days, I'm quite skeptical of things until I try them, I in terms of recipes and that sort of thing. But it's amazing what does work and why it works, and understanding. And also with pastry, definitely you follow the recipe. But once you've got a bit of confidence and you can actually, you know the recipe, then you start breaking the rules. But definitely don't break the rules with pastry and that style of cooking until you actually have a foundation of knowledge that allows you to break the rules.
Once you left culinary school, you made your way out to London. How did this culinary job?
London I went to, my brother had been just left to London, and I wanted to get it, desperate to get out of New Zealand as well, like most young Kiwis when they leave school want to go and do a OE and, spend a few years abroad. So London, I sort of stumbled across my first job there and didn't really know where I was going or what to do, didn't know a lot of people, so I took a first sort of job, but knew that within the first year of being in London, I was going to travel a lot as well. I was going to take 3 months off and go when I got there, I went and spent 2 months in Turkey, which was amazing. That was sort of 27 years ago now. Then I'd work for 4 or 5 months and then hand in my notice and go and work, go on holiday again, right, for another couple of months, 3 months. That's part of it, right? You've lived in New Zealand and were quite secluded from the rest of the world. So you really wanted to get out and see things and experience things. Probably the second year in London, I really got serious and got into a good kitchen and a really good restaurant and started to really focus on my job and career a little bit more.
And then you came back to Melbourne for to work under Jonathan Cook at SSS, which I think is like incredible. What was the time there, and then what were some of the things that began to really shape you as a under the tutelage?
Yeah, well, that was a really interesting process because when I stupidly let my visa run out in the UK, and I had about 2 weeks left, and I was working for a good guy there called Stephen Terry, and he said, "Well, you could go and work for a mate of mine, Gordon Ramsay. He might be able to sponsor you. Or if your only other option is to go to Australia, you could go and work for a friend of mine, Donovan Cook." So those are really my two options. And I ended up going down to Australia because the visa thing was just left too short. But Australia, I spent 3 years in Australia and I worked incredibly hard. Generally worked 6 days a week. We worked very early in the morning until very late at night. I didn't have much of a life, so I didn't really enjoy Melbourne as such very much. But I packed so much work into those 3 years. I literally worked my ass off and learned a huge, huge amount. So it was a real life-changing sort of 3 years for me. And I did 3 years solid with Donovan and took as much knowledge as possible as I could from them. So that was quite an integral part of my career.
What was one of the best things that he left you with?
It's just a hard work, detail and dedication and respect. He wouldn't let me touch fish or meat or, any official meat preparation until I had, everything else sorted. I used to have to come in earlier in the morning to try and get all my vegetable prep done and that sort of thing. And then if I wasn't done quick enough and I wasn't done fast enough and my work wasn't good enough, he wouldn't let me touch the fish or he wouldn't let me touch the meat. So he sort of drip fed that sort of stuff. And he had so much knowledge in that area. And he sort of made, he drip fed it to me and it taught me a huge amount of respect for being able to, work hard and you had to earn your stripes with him, definitely. But I learned the right way and it made me really, very good at my job very quickly.
From there, you went to luxury yachts. And I'm just so curious, after working in such kind of like high-end, really kind of like just accoladed starred restaurants, what did you take from luxury yachts? What was the kind of knowledge and skills that you left there with? And how many years were you on the boats?
I was only actually on boats for, I think, 4 months in total, and which is sort of a season, right? It's a summer season in Europe, and we were based in the south of France. And, on the whole, I didn't really enjoy that process. I loved, the best part about it was we would call into these, amazing little ports and various bays and different places, and we'd go ashore and go to the markets and look for produce, and it was hugely seasonal and amazing produce up and down the Italian coast or the French Riviera and out on the islands, and the cooking was really, really amazing, but it definitely wasn't for me. I was working with, it was myself as a sort of the chef, and then I had an assistant with me. And we probably had people on our boat half the time. So it's a funny old thing. You feel like you're living a life beyond your means because you live on this boat, and it's a strange one. I really wanted to be back in a kitchen, learning as much as I can could. So that's sort of why I left the yachts, did it for a small amount of time to get enough money to get back to London. And that's what it did provide me. It provided me a good cash influx to sort of actually get back into London and get myself set up again to get back into a good kitchen.
Right. And then this is the beginning of your 10 years with Chef Gordon Ramsay.
Yeah, I left the boat, did an interview with Gordon. He gave me a job pretty much on the spot. It had just been voted one of the worst places to work in Britain, actually. And he had just been on this show called Britain's Worst Bosses. And I went and spent a day in the kitchen and absolutely loved it. And, I didn't ask any questions, right? I wasn't bothered what I was getting paid or why or how many hours I was working. It was just, when can I start? I'm in. Let's go. And it was, I had an incredible, almost 7 years with him.
Which is phenomenal. And from him, I mean, you already had such great tutelage and such great chefs. So like, what were the lessons and like, what were the examples? Like, what did he teach you about being a restaurateur and a chef?
A lot of what I know today, definitely attention to detail because his standards were just so high and sort of don't leave any stone unturned. If you walk in and you have an intuition and you do as a chef, right, you walk into a kitchen and you have an intuition that something's not right, don't walk past it, dig under this and scratch under the surface, and it's amazing what you find. And don't ever assume anything, if produce and food and kitchens, they're an ever evolving thing, and produce changes and seasons change constantly, and everything's moving. Nothing that you deal with is generally, it's very hard to standardize. So you just have to constantly pay a huge amount of attention to everything you do and watch it constantly. Because as soon as you take the eye off it's gone wrong, I loved working for him. I loved working hard, and just working with passionate people. We were hugely focused on the food and the service, but, I was a chef, and as I've always been a chef, and hugely, hugely, hugely focused on the food. That was it. Be all and end all. If it's not right, it's gone. If it's great, it's great. We were just focused on making sure everything was fantastic every day.
And flipping it around the other side, you spent 5 seasons as a judge on MasterChef New Zealand. What advice and what kind of guidance did you find was the most useful for the contestants, or what type of critique did you feel kind of hit the heart of the contestants?
Yeah, a lot of the contestants, it was an amazing experience. And a lot of the contestants that came on board were really good cooks. You've got a lot of great cooks in New Zealand who are very, they've got a really good knowledge of the basics, and they love their food and are passionate about what they're doing. But a lot of it is organization, cleanliness, and structure. And you'd want to get them in and get them into a process pretty early. And we would have, this is one thing we could give them general advice on. As a group, we would sort of say, listen, you're going into a challenge. You need to get yourself set up. You need to get the right equipment around you early. You need to keep a clean bench. And although that's not focusing on the end product of the food, well, you work organized, you work better, and you work more logically. You're twice as fast. And the end result in the food is always better, and it just helps them get through. But the best thing about doing that show was just the food we ate. We ate incredibly good food a lot of the time, and that's a hugely enjoyable thing, right? To be cooked for and eat great food.
And to be paid.
Yeah, totally. And the disappointing thing is when the, if we had a day where we had not great food, you're not making a great show. It was difficult to make a great show with bad food because everyone just gets down. It's hard to be up and smiling about things when it becomes quite negative quite quickly because people you get depressed if you get bad food. You're like, oh God, that was terrible and that was great and that wasn't all good and it all just goes a bit sideways. So good food, great show. So it was really important that they were, had their best.
We're going to take a quick musical break and play a song from our archives, and then we'll be back with Josh Emmett.
Don't kiss me if you don't love me. Don't tell my heart a lie. Don't hold me if you don't want me. And it's too late to say goodbye.
And then we're back with Chef Emmett to talk about his new cookbook, The Recipe, here on Snacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network. So, Chef, you wrote a book called The Recipe, whose tagline is "The most important recipes everyone should cook in a lifetime." Before we get into the book, I'd love to know, what do you define as a classic recipe?
A classic recipe is something that is ingrained in people's lives and in their and in culture and in sort of all throughout society. And you know what these dishes are. They're dishes that that everyone knows. They all eat. They all have a sort of part of their lives. And whether that's, you know, that's something as simple as, you know, you're in England and it's prawn cocktail, or you're in, you know, part of America and that's a chowder, or, you know, a clam chowder or something like that. Or it's, you know, you're in Asia and it's congee. There's these recipes that have been around for a long, long time. They're there for a reason. They're great for a reason. They're very recognizable. If you ask, you know, your average person what it is, they'll generally know what it is. You know, some of these have become more prevalent in recent years. You know, like if you ask an average New Zealander what laksa is, they'll be able to tell you. They might not be able to list all the ingredients, but they may have eaten one, but they'll know what it is. And that's a recipe that's stretched far and wide out of Asia and almost become mainstream in Western culture. So they're those sorts of recipes. They have to be a thing, you know.
And so where did the genesis for this book come from? It's pretty audacious. It's 300 plus recipes that spans the last 50 years. It's very ambitious.
Hugely ambitious. And it's one of these projects that if we had known how difficult it was going to be when we started, you would never start. You
That's
know, we decided to do, the 300 or 400 greatest recipes from the last 50 to 100 years. And the recipes supplied by, you know, the world's finest chefs. So there's one thing to compile that list of recipes and decide on what actually belongs in the book, and then to match them to chefs from around the world who generally specialize in those areas, and get the chefs on board to provide the recipes. And that was, you know, it was a huge process, a very slow process to begin with. A very ambitious project, but we came out with an incredible result.
Were the recipes non-negotiable? Once you had the set list, did you have to find a chef, meet them, or would chefs get into discourse with you to be like, that's not a classic, this is a classic, and you would adapt to, you know, the discussion with the chef?
No, we would send out a list to a lot of the chefs in the early days, and we would suggest what we thought they would do based on, you know, their area of expertise. Or they might say, actually, I want to do that one, but I want to do this one as well. So they might do two recipes. Some chefs did three recipes. Majority did one recipe. And, you know, we were looking for sort of 150 chefs from around the world. And that was it was an incredibly emotional experience for me. I know probably 50% no one have met. I know 30 or 40% well of the chefs that are in the book. I know another 10 or 15% I've met. And then there's a percentage that I, you know, haven't met, but I've had contact with over the process of doing the book. But, you know, sitting in here from little old New Zealand and getting an answer from a chef in, you know, in Paris or in London or New York or whatever that had agreed to participate and pass their recipes was, you know, there was some pretty incredible happy days down here, and other days when we didn't get people that we wanted to be involved was quite difficult as well. But once we got that snowballing and the ball rolling, you know, the real pressure on me was that I had to produce something that was exceptional, and that was sort of dawned on me as we slowly moved through the process.
Yeah. Was there one particular white whale that you're like, you know, I love everyone equally, but you really wanted this particular chef in the book?
No, I don't think there was one particular person, but there's a group of chefs, I guess, that we were, you know, there's people that I have huge amounts of respect for. So it's a real mixture, you know. I was super ecstatic that obviously Gordon Ramsay came on board, and you know that wasn't a shoo-in just because I'd worked for him for years. You know, everyone's extremely busy, and taking time to send recipes is hard work. You know, there's people like Nigel Slater, who's incredible. You know, you got David Kinch, who runs amazing restaurants, and David Chang, Elena and Juan Marie Arzac, who run, you know, Arzac restaurant in Spain. You know, they're like Spanish royalty when it comes to, you know, food and cooking and chefs. So they've been there so many years, and Sophie Peake, who you know, has got two or three Michelin stars and an incredible chef, Martha Stewart, you know, to get her to agree and be part of it. But the, you know, there's 150 of those names in the book, you've seen the list. It's a pretty incredible list, and some, you know, it's very humbling.
So when the realization dawned on you of what you had to do, what changed in your process, or if anything, or what kind of doubling down did you feel that you had to do once the legend of the culinary world started to say yes?
Well, it definitely dawned on me. There was a couple of mornings where I just woke up and was like, oh my God, then it was the process that we got the recipes, we got the chefs, the recipes started being sent to me. And I'm cooking all these recipes in my home, with one help from a girl called Christy, who's always helped me with my first two cookbooks. But the pressure of, you know, this book has to be incredible. It has to represent all these people. It has to be beautiful. And Karen Scott, who is a photographer, I've worked with him on two previous books and works with him a lot. He's a seriously clever guy and really knows what angle and what sort of direction this book should take. And the book sort of takes a life of its own, right? That's why we turned around and just shot. It was trying to take these personalities that were involved in the book out of the book a little bit, because the book is about the recipe. So we shot every dish either on a white or black plate and on a white or black background, and generally always overhead shots. So the focus is very much on the food, the dish, that's it. You know, and that flows through the book in terms of the font and the text and how it's written. It's written in a sort of a manual format with tips and tricks and that sort of thing, but the focus is 100% on the food. And that's really what it was about. We had a chef that, you know, wanted to send a photograph of their picture of their food rather than us photographing it. And we sort of had to know, even though he's an incredible, one of the best known chefs in the world, we had to say no to that because it doesn't fit within the images of the rest of the book. And it all has to fit perfectly. So, you know, it did take a bit of a life of its own, which I suppose took some pressure off me, but it's still you're still putting someone else's dish on a plate, which it has to look incredible. They all do.
Yes. One of the interesting things about this book is that it's obvious that the recipes are the chefs, but they also come with accompanying Josh notes. Could you give a little insight into the tips and the tricks that you provide for some of the recipes?
Yeah, the Josh tips are really about any time you cook a recipe for the first time, you need there's something you'll pick up along the way, right? And you'll go, oh shit, next time I'll do it that way, or I'll need to know that for next time, you know, because you either use it, and they're really simple things. They could be the size of the bowl that you mixed it in, or it could be the way you mixed it, or it could be the steps you did, or all sorts of little tricks. Those are the tips that I tried to provide, so that the first time someone's making this recipe, they do hit those certain points, and that way it's a no fail, right? And that's what it's really about, just the tricks and tips that will allow you to get it right the first time. And these, you know, these recipes are recipes, yeah, as we say, that people must cook and should cook or eat at least once in their lifetime. And most people probably have.
What advice do you have, or what's some of the best advice you have for home cooks who are tackling this book for the first time?
I think people get wary that there's a lot of complex recipes, but I would say 90% of the recipes in this book are simple, are an easy category. There's a few ambitious ones in there. But the one, you know, you could say that one of the ambitious ones, I've got it actually written as easy, but Sean Brock's, fried chicken and gravy. Now it's a labor intensive two day job to do this fried chicken. And funnily enough, I made it for my kid's birthday last week. And it is next level fried chicken. I mean, it's the best fried chicken recipe I've ever had and eaten. It's unbelievable. So advice to people is just to get in there and cook. You know, cooking's a feeling thing. You know, it's like making pasta for the first time. The first time, you're probably going to make a really bad job of it. The second time, you start to get a feel. The third time, and fourth and fifth, it starts to come out glorious. You know, you don't always expect to get things right on the first time. So, you know, doing a dish and then repeating it's always a good thing.
After getting all of these recipes and discussing with these legends, you must have found some commonalities between them, or found some kind of like something that bound them together that allowed them to become these creative culinary geniuses. What are some of the things that you discovered about them that link them as creatives and human beings?
There's a huge love of food, I think. I think you should never think that any dish is below anyone, you know, because it's just not. It doesn't matter whether people are, you know, specialize in, you know, three Michelin star high end cuisine, that simple foods below them. Because it's not, it never has been. In fact, it's probably more ingrained in their life than anything. Or that someone who cooks really simple food in a restaurant and runs whether it's a fried chicken shop or something else, that don't have an appreciation of more complex dishes. I think the bottom line with most of the chefs is a massive love of food across the board. Now, whether that's down and dirty or slick and polished, you know, there's an intrigue and a love and a consistency across that for the industry and for food in general.
Having cooked through all these recipes and doing that, I know the fried chicken is a favorite, but what is the one or two that you've even slipped into your restaurants or to your home cooking rotation after doing all 150 chef submissions?
Yeah, there's a classic recipe, a cassoulet recipe from a French chef called Pascal Orsignac, who lives in London. That is, you know, I've cooked that multiple times. That is next level. It's a beautiful cassoulet recipe. There's all sorts of, really delicious desserts. The tiramisu I've made quite a few times, which is from Mark Vetri. Love that. There's a baked sort of custard pudding, which is from a chef in South Africa, actually. And I've made that multiple times at home, and it's really good. The kids absolutely love it, and it's a really straightforward recipe. So all sorts. You can take the inkling of an idea or one part of the recipe or even a technique in the recipe. And again, through this process, I learned so much because, there was recipes that got sent to me. And, you know, I'm at the stage where I read a lot of cookbooks, but I don't follow I read, look at the pictures, and I know what I'm going to do with it. But to go back and actually follow 300 recipes, other people's recipes, and have to follow them to T. There was a percentage of the recipes I looked at and went, really? I'm not really sure about that technique, or whether that's, I wouldn't do it like that. I haven't seen it done like that. So there was a lot of stuff I learned that was new to me, which was brilliant. That was part of the learning process for me.
Incredible. Well, Chef, thank you so much for putting the effort into compiling this incredible book. And thank you for making time for us on the show. Where can people find the book, visit your restaurants, send you recipes, get a hold of you?
Yeah, Instagram, restaurants, and I've got restaurants throughout New Zealand, Rata, which is in Queenstown, Madam Wu, I've got four of those across the country in New Zealand as well. And yeah, definitely Instagram. We spend a lot of time on Instagram, actually, which is at Josh Emmett. We do a lot of recipes on there, including some from the book, actually, to help people with that daily slog of what am I going to eat for dinner tonight. So we post a lot of simple recipes on there to really enable people to sort of get through the week and try a few different things and eat well.
Amazing. Thank you again. We're going to take another quick musical break with a song from our archives, and then Jeet will be in the studio live with Mia Gladstone here on Snacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network.
This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 40 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on an eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian seating areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. This is Jeet. I am here in the studio with Mia Gladstone. Welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Thank you so much.
How was it getting here? I heard the L train was a bit of a bitch.
Yeah. Are we allowed to curse on here?
Absolutely.
Okay, cool. Yeah, it was really annoying. I thought I left enough time because I got to Penn Station super early, and then I got to the train and it was like, it'll be here in 20 minutes.
Oh, where are you coming from?
I come from Jersey.
Oh, okay. Yeah, me too.
Where?
Jersey City.
Okay, yeah. So you're more at a more commutable place. I'm in South Orange, so
transit. Wait, you got to get to, New Jersey Transit to Penn Station.
It's so annoying, yeah, and then...
Oh my God, how annoying.
Yeah, but it's it's just short enough to still be doable, but long enough to be the most annoying, most repetitive thing in the world.
But you're here.
I'm here.
And that's what's important.
Yes, yes.
So how'd you get into music?
I've been doing music forever. It's just innate within me. It's my number one thing that I do.
Were you... around musical family members or?
Yeah, my dad, I guess I just grew up surrounded by music. It was always something that we were listening to. And
what kind of music?
Well, my dad, all kinds. My dad really liked classic rock,
suburban
white
do.
Dad.
All dads do.
This is the classic rock. And then my mom really liked Kanye, and she liked more of the hip hop kind of stuff.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah, it was a very interesting mix. And then I guess I kind of found my style because my dad gave me an MP3 player when I was mm-hmm. 6, and he just loaded hundreds of songs onto it.
Yeah.
And I gravitated towards Stevie Wonder, Lauryn Hill, Steely Dan.
Nice.
David Bowie.
That's pretty eclectic.
Yeah, it's all over the place.
So how did you get from listening to all these different kinds of influences and then starting to write your own music? Where did that start?
Well, I started writing music when I was 6 or 7.
Wow, that's young.
It was, yeah. Well, because I asked my dad to teach me piano when I was 7. And so he didn't know how to play piano.
Wait, do your parents play music at all?
My dad always played guitar growing up.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
So I asked him to teach me piano or get me piano lessons. And he was mm-hmm. I don't really want to pay for lessons. So I'm going to learn piano myself. And I'm going to teach you. So he learned piano online, and then he just taught me, and I don't know how to read music or anything. I kind of just learned the notes and the
chords.
That's
a pretty kick-ass dad.
Pretty kick-ass. Yeah. I'm so grateful because it was awesome. And the second I was able to play piano, chords and stuff, that's when I was able to actually put all my ideas into song. So yeah, around when I was 7, I guess.
Wow. Very interesting.
Yeah.
So you get into music at around 6 or 7, and you start writing music around that time too?
Yeah, because in second grade, I had this school talent show, and mm-hmm. I was I guess I'm just going to play a song and sing on piano. I didn't know what I was going to play, but then I just ended up writing a song, and that's what I performed.
An original composition?
Yeah.
For a talent show? That's amazing.
Yeah, and then it just became this thing that every year I would do the talent show, and I'd always have songs for that, so it was a big motivator in writing
music. So when did you
music.
Start recording these ideas?
Recording, I think the first time I really recorded was when I was in 5th grade.
Because mm-hmm.
My dad, he had a recording setup and stuff.
Oh my god,
home.
Your dad is like
my dad is my
all around engineer.
He helped me so much. He engineered the session. Oh my god,
that's amazing.
It's so cringy though when I look back on it because I heard the recording many years later and my voice was so shrill and undeveloped, obviously as a 5th grader, but it's still on the harmonies and stacks that I do now,
just
a little kid voice.
Oh my god.
Yeah, it was a lot, but
it really laid the foundation, I assume.
It really did, yeah. I was wow, I can. And also I think it was back in the day, it wasn't I would record an idea bit by bit. It was I had to write the whole song before I would record. Versus now, my process is very broken up. I'll start with the beat, I'll do a little bit of the beat, I'll do some vocals over it, and I'll build off of it little by little. So I feel having that foundation of the discipline of making the whole song was really good.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I kind of want to get back to that because I feel like I was a better songwriter when I could just
do that. Oh, that's fascinating. I definitely want to talk about that more, but let's move into a song. Let's perform first for us?
Okay, so the first song I'm going to do is called My Tits Grow in the Winter.
Love the title.
Thank you. It's a song about body dysmorphia. And yeah, that it's a, just a short little snippet.
When I'm talking to you, baby, can't you tell me how to feel? Da 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 ba da do, da 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 ba da do. Do you love me as much as you say? How do you really know what you mean? Baby, tell me what pops in your brain when you see the image of me in your face. Yeah, tits grow in the winter. It throws me out of center. Yeah, my tits grow in the winter. It throws me out of center. Yeah, yeah. I be looking in the mirror. There's this bitch, she's staring back. I never see her. I'm always so confused why she always seems to pop up in my view. I don't know her. Tits grow in the winter. It throws me out of center. Yeah, my tits grow in the winter. It throws me out of center. Yeah, yeah. Da 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 da. Da 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 da.
So let's talk about your new single, Geekin'.
Let's talk about it. Yeah, I dropped it super recently. It's a self-produced track.
So you did everything.
I did everything.
You made the beat.
I did.
You recorded your voice.
Mm-hmm. And I got my boy Cicero is featuring on it.
Wow, very cool.
Thank you. Yeah, that song. Should I talk about how it like?
Yes,
came
absolutely.
Together? Cool. Well, I made it for my Splice Pack originally.
Nice.
So I had to make like a sample beat for it. So the beat is also comprised of like my vocals. Mm-hmm. Like that's mm-hmm. what I sampled. And basically, I had to go to DC to record this video for Splice. And then my boy Cicero is from DC, so I was gonna have him hop on the beat. And yeah, so we like did this whole thing, this whole video, and then I really liked how the song came out, but I kind of slept on it. And then maybe like 6 months later, I came across it and I was like, I should finish this song. So we just ended up finishing the song, and it was like a family production because it was recorded and engineered by Owen, who's at Beyond Studios in DC. Mm-hmm. And then he ended up mixing it at the end, too. And it was just like a DMV production, the whole thing, because we recorded it there, too.
Got it.
Yeah.
So this is kind of like what you were saying before, where the songwriting is kind of in pieces. And funny enough, for Splice, which is, if anybody doesn't know, is where you find beats, basically. But you said that you want to start trying to go back to writing full-fledged songs.
Well, yeah, just to challenge myself a little more, because in this like new era I'm in my career, I've been producing everything myself. Mm. And so it's become this thing where I'm like, okay, well, to get the bass line started, like I'll just make the beat and then I'll do my part and then I'll be like, oh, I'll add this to the beat. Rather than like, it's not like I make the full beat first, like it's a constant building block.
Do you feel
things.
Like anytime like it's too much to be able to have to do everything? Do you feel like there's too much on your shoulders?
No, well, not really, because it was like completely my choice to do this because I wanted to kind of reverse the roles. And I found when I first got into the industry, I was like, oh, I guess now I'm just a singer and I'm going to have to like sing over beats that other people make and do all this shit. Mm. And then I realized I don't have to do that at all. And
I can take
control and take the power back. And It's been super empowering and rewarding to produce everything myself, and especially continuing to reverse the roles by like featuring rappers on my tracks that I produce. It feels really good.
It sounds like you are your father's daughter.
That I am.
That's amazing. That's really cool.
Thank you.
So did you said you make a you say you make a made a music video for this?
Yes.
The song?
Yeah.
So what was that process like?
Well, that was amazing. It hasn't come out yet. We're like, I'm super
very
excited.
Exciting.
Yeah. we shot it. It was, I'm trying to think, like, so it was originally supposed to be in one day, like, and Cicero came from DC for this shoot.
Wow,
and then basically
cool.
like last minute where we were supposed to film all this green screen stuff, they like flaked on us. And I had done this really elaborate makeup and I had so much shit with me.
Yeah.
And we had to reschedule it and Cicero had to go home. So I had to like bring him back the next week. And it was like, oh my God, it was so stressful. But now I'm so happy that we did it.
Oh yeah?
Yeah, because everybody around me was kind of like, I don't know if it's worth it for you to do a video for this song. Like, it's so last minute. But I was like, nah, I'm doing the video. Like, it's going to be worth it. And now I'm seeing it paying off. Like, it feels really good.
And your videos are quite out there. I saw the Baby Don't Worry video.
Yeah.
Man, what was that like? The glitter. Oh my God.
Glitter tits. God. Yeah, that was very intense. I don't know, like, Yeah, I mean, I had done the full glitter body look before, so it wasn't my first time, but it was, I definitely made a mess. It was like a lot to clean up, a lot to put on, because you have to put like a layer of baby oil first over your skin and then glitter so that the glitter sticks, you know? So it's like,
I see.
A lot goes into it.
See, I'm not too familiar with glitter on the body.
I don't think most people are.
Yeah, it's not a very common thing.
But it was definitely fun. I didn't feel naked. Like, okay. Walking around, I was like, I feel like I'm wearing a bodysuit right now.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, I feel great.
That's amazing. So what are you going to sing for us next?
Okay, next, I'm going to sing a song called Don't Look At Me. And I wrote this song after a lot of frustrations being on the subway and people always staring at me when I'm just trying to mind my business and me just feeling like a target as a young woman. Oh, shout out Fresco. I can take 2 steps along the street without turning hella heads. I think they're onto me. I go about my business on the screen, but they yearning for my life information on she. It's a beautiful day, so I don't care that you can look away. And I'ma stare back and forth my body and your feet, having trouble choosing between longing and your needs. You look me up and down like I'm a treat, thinking I don't see the way your fantasies unleash. I stare ahead so far away, so I don't meet your gaze. Beware of a lonely man. Your mind travels unraveling your dignity and purity. Spare yourself the trouble, you ain't getting nowhere near my bubble. I'm not flattered, I'ma kick you to the rubble. Go about my day, my vision turns into a tunnel. I'ma live my life, cause it's a beautiful day. So I don't care that you back.
Very cool.
I appreciate it.
So you just mentioned in the last segment that your next song, Geekin, is in the works.
The music video is in the works,
right? The song's done.
The song's out.
Mixed, mastered, out.
Uh-huh.
On Spotify.
Uh-huh.
Tidal.
All of the above.
All streaming services.
Yes.
It is available. When's the music video coming out?
We're not sure. I'm supposed to get a cut of it today.
Oh my God. That sounds exciting.
I'm so excited. I keep checking my email.
Have you, like, what's the big difference between the first cut and the final one? Like, from the music videos I've done in the past?
Oh my God. It's different for every video.
Is it like night and day, or is it like?
It really depends. It depends on who you're working with. Like, and it also depends on how clear the plan is going into it.
Yeah.
A lot of my videos were not very planned. So then, like, in the editing process, I have no idea what to expect, and I'll get it back and I'll be like, okay, I like this, don't like this, but I don't know. I think I think for the Geekin' video, I'm really excited to see the first cut, and I have a feeling it'll be very close to the final cut.
Nice.
Because Jisun, who I'm working with on it, is just incredible, and like her editing skills are really,
she's the
really
director,
cool.
Or?
She's a director, editor.
Shout
yeah,
out.
She, shout out, Jisun. Yeah, she's amazing. So that's yeah, awesome. It should be really cool.
So when that comes out, you'll probably do some shows?
Yeah, I have a show on Thursday, actually.
This Thursday?
On the 19th, yeah.
Whereabouts?
Market Hotel.
Market Hotel, you heard it here.
Heard it here first.
Awesome. Any yeah. other shows planned after that? Any tours?
Tours, definitely in 2020.
Nice.
To end 2019, I'm doing a show in New Jersey, my hometown, on the 30th. And then I have another show in like Montclair, which is right next to my hometown.
I love Montclair.
In January.
Oh my God, I love Montclair. It's such
it's a
pretty
great place.
Town.
Yeah.
If it wasn't so expensive, I would totally live there.
Yeah, it's really fucking expensive. But hey, they got really good vegan food, so.
So you're playing on the 30th of December? Wow, 2 days before New Year's.
I know. Amazing. And I'm going to Atlanta right before then. It's going to be really busy.
That's a wild, wild
it's
way to.
Wild
way to bring the new year in.
It is. Bring in the new decade. Can you
oh
believe
my
this?
God.
I keep tweaking about it when I think about it, I'm like, holy shit, it's 2020. We're about to be in the roaring 20s.
2020. Jeez.
We're going to thrive.
We are. We're going to
really
do well.
Excited.
We're all going to do well.
I think it's going to be the last 10 years that are like livable for humanity.
I don't think so.
I mean,
we'll be okay.
Yeah, we'll be fine. I don't know.
If certain things change, we'll be fine.
I guess we'll see.
How long have you been in the music industry per se now?
I guess I would consider like, well, I got out of high school like 3 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and that's when I like fully immersed myself in the industry.
Okay, so about 3 years, right?
It was 3 years, yeah.
So
yeah.
Like, so are the things that you really like about it? And there are other things that you absolutely
yeah.
can't stand.
Should I talk about them?
Let's do the positive.
The
first.
Positive first.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I really love all the collaboration and like
yeah.
just the music community. It yeah. has been really incredible. Like, I keep finding myself having these bursts of gratitude where I'm like, wow, I'm surrounded by really amazing people who are like really pushing things forward. And
yeah, yeah.
People, I really like meeting people who aren't concerned about clout and all the bullshit that comes with being a musician, and people who just genuinely want to like connect as humans and make music.
That's
been really amazing, just who I've found myself surrounded by.
Yeah. Those are, there are people like that, and they're far and few, but when they're there, just clicks.
Exactly.
Totally
yeah, you
it.
Meet somebody and you're like, I think I've known you forever.
Yeah. There's something so deep about whatever it is about music that really connects us. Like when you find that person, it's like you fall in love a little bit.
Yeah, no, totally.
You know?
That's also something I learned through music, that like being in love doesn't have to be a romantic thing. Like
right.
you can just be in love. Like I feel like I'm in love all the time because I just live in love.
That's
you
beautiful.
You know what I mean?
That's really beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, really let's nice. Switch it over. What do you not like? What would you like to change about the music
okay.
industry?
Well, I would love all like the isms to go away, like the sexism within music, the racism, like just all the oppression that's within the industry. I found just as a woman, it's definitely been challenging. Like I have very different perspectives of people than like my male peers have. Like we'll be in a session with somebody, or like we'll know somebody in common, and they'll be like, oh yeah, he's such a cool dude, like we've made amazing music together. And I'll be like, oh, he like was extremely inappropriate with me and made me feel like an object. And it's just
going back to the Subway song, right?
Yeah, well, it's sad. It's like apparent in everything, but I think in music people really get away with it because it's such a casual industry. It's like because music, the music industry is like, you're just living in the industry.
Right.
So there's like really no boundaries. You know how in most industries, it's like you don't combine business and pleasure. But
yeah.
music is business
and pleasure.
Right.
So
it's like,
I would say entertainment industry in
entertainment
general.
Industry.
Yeah.
yeah, definitely. So it's a whole lot of like unprofessional people. And
so hopefully the next decade will be filled with more professionalism.
Yeah, and just right. being surrounded by more professionals.
More professionals who are in it for the music, not
for
the clout.
Music. Yeah, and not for the
in
sex.
In it for the love.
In it for the love. That's the most important thing. When you're moving with love, you don't have to worry about like offending people, and you don't have to
yeah.
worry about any of that shit, because totally it's all love.
Speaking of sharing love, is there anybody you want to shout out? Any other artists that
you're... God. Yeah, shout out to my parents. I record at home. Like, I moved away from home for a bit, and then I've been back for a little while, and I'm, like, so grateful to my parents for allowing me to transform, like, this office in our crib, like, into my studio.
Big, big shout out to the parents out there. Much love.
Much love.
Where can people find you?
They can find me everywhere at Mia Gladstone.
Awesome.
Spotify, Apple, whatever, have it. Instagram, Twitter.
So easy. Mia Gladstone.
Mia Gladstone. Yeah.
Perfect. And with that, let's do the last song.
This is a song called Grow. Uh-huh. I produced this myself.
What's it about?
It is about growing, baby. It's about universal love and everything that fuels my heart.
Baby, I grow like a flower, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Baby, I grow like a flower. I'm like the sweetest of sour. I got the flow like a shower. Come pick my brain for an hour. Pinnacle of power. I hold my ground like a tower. Cynical, I empower. I came to stay, I'm no coward. I'm so divine like universal love. Oh. I'm so divine like you. I get bigger and stronger, da-ba-dee-da-ba-da-dee-do. I fear my passion, no other, couldn't lose, I'm a lover. I tell the truth, but I stutter, know what to choose, I don't hover. Na-na-na-no-no-no, oh yeah, yeah. Na-na-na-na-na-no, I'm so divine. You're so divine, just close your eyes, expose your light.
We talk about food, we talk about music, with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for...
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, the French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.